Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello, and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt. Since today's show is being recorded at the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books, which is held at UCLA, you may hear the noise of the festival in the background. Today my guest is Nathan Englander, the author of For the Relief of Unbearable Urges, a book of short stories from Knopf. It's his first book. And I guess I first have to say that it's been many years since I encountered a book of short stories whose themes involved Judaism that really had new life. If there is a kind of travel of ethnicity and culture, I had thought that the world of the Jews in fiction had passed from the face of the earth, and then came the world of women, and then came the world of African Americans, and then came the world of gays. So the book seems to carry in it the springtime, of a certain kind of literary culture, which was very pleasant for me. Had you written other kinds of stories first?
It's hard to define. I mean, I consider this, this is, do we count high school angst poetry? I mean, this book was my education. I mean, these are my first day, 27th man. I got that idea. I was probably 19 or something. I mean, this was my education. I worked on these stories, some of them for 5 years, 6 years. And
It's really wonderful because they have the tone of things that have emerged over time. In fact, the better ones are the ones, it seems to me, that come out of having been written, it felt like, so many times that by now the stories could even exist almost as a summary of a much longer manuscript, but the material had been integrated or really brought to a kind of depth so that it could be written simply. Do the stories have that kind of complicated history of rewriting?
Oh, I'm thrilled that you feel that or felt that. I measure the drafts in feet, not pages, but something like the Tumblers has been through so many endless drafts and forms and shape. I mean, there's, 160 page version, and there's a three-generation, nine-page version that I started with where they end up in Brooklyn running a bakery, and all these. I mean, it's taken on many, 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 many forms. That one, I say it sounds ridiculous. It's that sort of back of the best American type thing where you see people, I wrote this story for 100 years and I had 6 heart attacks in the interim, and I didn't know till I started writing that you live with these stories for so long. But the Tumblers particularly, and the 27th Man, those two I spent years on. I mean, the Tumblers, I actually had written it once I found the form that I wanted and where the story started and ended, which changed to the last minute. I actually wrote that one, I mean, this sounds ridiculous, but almost backwards. I was so used to forward, I went with the last scene and just knew it that well that I would write a scene and write the scene prior and worked my way forward, only to work back again.
Sometimes it's so amazing. There are certain stories that, because they've been written over such a long period, come to new life every time you look at them. I think in particular of a story that I know that you like too, Grace Paley's story, Goodbye and Good Luck.
Yes.
When I read that, every time I find another phrase, no more tea, I am already a samovar, or knowledge of Yiddish theater that seems to have been compacted and compacted so that you hardly notice it's there the first time you read it, but there it is.
I mean, that story for me is still a mystery. That's why it's one of my favorites. I mean, in your very kind introduction, you talk about, you know, Jewish fiction, and it's exactly that it's really not about writing any form of fiction. I mean, I completely reject that. It's obvious everyone else is going to call these Jewish stories, but you write your stories. I mean, I get very nervous about Jewish fiction or gay fiction or, you know, any putting things in genres like that, genres that allow for things to be a little less than what they should be. I mean, basically, they should just be fictions about. But that's it. That Goodbye and Good Luck is a story. It's so deeply about the human condition. I mean, that's mm-hmm. why I love that story, because I read it. I don't know how she did it. I know what's in there. It's nothing, you know, it's the story about the working in the Yiddish theater, and you get to the end there and you just weep. I mean, it's, and there's something very, there's a thread of knowledge so deep running through that story, and I still haven't figured out how she did it or where it is, but it kills me every time.
Every time, you know. And I guess the reason one calls it a Jewish story rather than something else is that it comes clearly from a field of personal experience that could not have had these words in this order so perfectly well if it were not coming from a region of the heart that contains personal experience. So it's not relevant necessarily that it's Jewish. It's relevant that somehow the story tells you that this material is deeply known.
I mean, I guess that's why I gravitated towards this world, because there's, I mean, for me, it's what can you wrap your brain around? There's, I mean, basically, you're framing in a story, especially a short story. It's, you know, there's so much work to be done, and I feel like, innately or because of my education, you know, whether I've, you know, given up religion or not, but that sort of brain patterning, that functioning, you know, this is kosher, this is not. So it allows for a certain, if you're going to ask me about morality, we'll be here all day. What's moral, what's immoral, what's right and wrong. It was very nice for me to have a system that I know, and then to be able to explore what's truly important to me with certain rights and wrong. You know, are you allowed to steal? No. I don't want to get into the evolved. Are you stealing from this and this company and the, so yes, it allowed me to work to start with basics. You know, up is up, down is down. There's right, there's wrong, and then I think it allowed me to forge further.
Well, one of the more startling places in the book comes when a man, having had the revelation in a taxi cab that he's Jewish, goes to a kind of radical rabbi, who says to him, "No. It doesn't matter that your mother was not Jewish. Forget about the mother. Forget about all. The soul is Jewish." And it seems almost like a categorical statement here that there is something about the soul that is essentially Jewish if you're working at that level, at that depth. Do you agree, or is that just the character's presentation?
It's not a matter of agree or disagree. In a sense, if you ask me about where these stories come from, this is what I write, and I'm simply and only concerned with the characters and the story and working on the story. I mean, when you say that, it starts the wheels spinning, because then I wonder about me and my own issues of identity, in a sense, you know, because of the freakish fact that I was, you know, completely Orthodox and left it all and then go to be radically secular in Jerusalem. I mean, there's something about that. But, you know, and where we are, you know, all embroiled in this argument of, well, you know, if the conversion's Orthodox, then you are a Jew. If it's conservative, you're not. You know, this measurements of who's more Jewish and less Jewish. And I mean, I guess that's been rolling around, this very idea of, or the way I was raised, in a sense. I guess this is you pick radical elements for a story of basic issues, but this idea of who defines who is Jewish, in a sense. I mean, I didn't think about that. When you say that, it makes me think that, yes, I'm very sensitive about this idea of people, you know, having a monopoly on Judaism, because you can't.
I'm very curious. I myself live in an area of Los Angeles that is the densest area of Hasidic Jews, mm-hmm. the Fairfax district. And the other day, my friend and I bought a bunch of smoke bombs from some yeshiva boys. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they were very hip and strange. Right. You know, they said, "You going to call the cops?"
Right.
"If you call the cops, I'm going to kill you."
Right.
And I was wondering, you know, what it takes to make one's way enough outside the community to become
the smoke bomb dealer.
Yes, or a short story writer.
Yes. Well, I wasn't. I was, you know, modern Orthodox, but in a sense also, when you say, how do I have access to that? If you know halakha, if you know Jewish law, that's it. You know, there's not, a different hat is, doesn't make you more or less religious either. You live halachically, you're religious or you're not. I mean, that's how I was raised, and that's why I feel like I don't have a problem switching between those worlds. It's a matter of certain simple traits. But never sold smoke bombs. But how does one? I have no idea, in a sense. I mean, I feel like there's some parallel. I really don't like to link the two, in a sense. I mean, I'm sure there's some deep-rooted link, but I hate for that idea of that. The writing fiction is not a rebellious act. I mean, I'm basically a monk, and this is, you know, this is that idea, because I feel like it leads toward that, where we start this with a story of someone, you know, being naughty on the street, and it's that idea where I feel like I do those own things where people always ask me, what am I worried about the community's reactions? And I say, why? Because I don't respect them at all and think they can't read fiction and understand that this is a respectful treatment. But that's my first instinct, is to say, they're going to be angry at what? And it's that same thing with myself, I guess. That,
oh, how interesting. You know, I was thinking rather the reverse, that there was something aesthetic that such an upbringing would provide, that would give you the essential honesty.
Aesthetic or ascetic?
Both.
I mean, I think more the ascetic. I you know, I say it jokingly, but it's true in terms of dedication or dedication, living a structured life. I mean, you know, in leaving, then I'd be, you know, you give up this whole massive structure. But in terms of writing, it's very similar. I always compare it to religion or yoga or any of the above, but things that you do every day, whether you want to or not. And it was that. I feel when I added the element of a day off, that a very kind editor friend, and I said, you know, Shabbos. Like, I didn't know, because I used to, you know, work myself into the ground. No, you need to, you know, take a day off. Take Tuesday, go to the movies on Tuesday. And that. But yeah, those structures help immensely. But in terms of story, I'll tell you what the real gift for me was is not Santa Claus stories. Not when the adult says, yeah, Santa's going to come down the chimney and then goes and dresses up as Santa. But that these, you know, grown men and women are telling you, and not even a Torah story, but an Haggadah, or, you know, a real, you know, Bible myth written by some guy writing on someone else's commentary and someone else's commentary. I mean, the greatest, you know, just a tale, you know, a Twain type thing, and telling you, believing in their heart of hearts, you know, not even things very, you know, far from the text of Pharaoh's daughter reached out for Moses, and he was, of course, the alligators all around, and her arm became 15 feet long, you know, as she reached out, and them telling you this and knowing, you know, seeing in their eyes, like, yes, her arm became 15 feet long to pull that, that was the miracle. Yes. And then, you know, when I did my secular Judaic studies degree, when I did my BA in Lit and all that, I also did a double major. I did, it was a long time ago, I guess, or not that long, but nonetheless, you know, secular Judaic studies, because I wanted to see, and it was, you know, I flipped through the Bible. Still, I go look for a story, and I can't find half the things that I place in where we'd pause and hold our finger in and then go off. But I think hearing those stories as truth, as absolute truth, you know, and even that idea, you know, which is sometimes, you know, fire and brimstone, but, you know, you'll be punished for this, that right and wrong also, you know, you know, the kid goes skiing on Saturday and breaks his leg. Yeah, need I say more? And I think those structures really did help with, I mean, those are the things I'm thankful for. Less the fire and brimstone, but more the belief in stories as truth.
Well, I think in particular of Kafka in the episode in his journals where he describes a Rebbe coming to town. He wants to see, he says, the sewer system. So he and his assistants are being led through the town, and nothing must come between the Rebbe and what he's looking at. Nothing can block his view. And so the assistants are always scurrying around, because the rabbi has a tendency, at least according to Kafka, to turn around suddenly, and then there are all these people who are caught in his eviscerating vision, and they have to go running to the sides to get out of his way. And for Kafka, this is the miracle, that the rabbi wants to see the sewers.
Right.
That somehow or other, the very holy and the very secular are meeting eye to eye, and they must not be interrupted by the banal or the daily. Nothing else must get in the way. The holy must meet the ordinary.
But this is classic. I mean, you just brought back a story I haven't thought of in a long time, and you'll have to show me where to find that in Kafka's journals, I insist. But that was it. It's the idea that all is in the holy. I mean, that is one of the great, you know, that, you know, this belief. I remember one of my, you know, Rebbe's telling me about his Rebbe, this idea that if they need to do brain surgery, if they know they can, yes, you know. And I remember him telling a question about, with tears in his eyes, about his Rebbe looking at the plans whether you could use a certain water fountain in on Shabbos, you know, whether this water fountain was electric, was the water being recooled. And but this idea of saying that, that it was his knowledge, he'd never seen a blueprint in his life, they laid it out, he figured out the whole thing. I mean, this, but it's exactly that moment, like this, the tie-in between water fountain blueprints and you know, all is holy in a sense, but all knowledge is in the holy. So yes, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I feel like Kafka tells the story the way it would have, you know, been told by one of his followers, if you say it that way, this idea.
Well, not only that, but the feeling, you see, again, pardon me for reaching for Kafka, but I do think that there's something, if you have been raised a certain way, there's a certain ultimacy in thinking that is full of proscription, mm-hmm. the sense of the forbidden. So when Kafka says to his father, in my dream, you are lying on the map of the world. In the countries you do not cover, there is no marriage. And in the countries that you cover, I cannot imagine myself being married in a country that you cover. This is almost like that kind of holy law.
Mm-hmm.
You shall not do this on Saturday. You shall mm-hmm. not cross the street on... The almost arbitrary but ultimate, the mm-hmm. surrealist idea followed with a very literal consequence. It's sort of amazing, and I find it in your stories as well, that sense that if the people stop being obedient, they will be crazy, that lying on the other side of the careful religious practice is a certain kind of psychosis of the son who goes mad having witnessed too bright a revelation. It seems to me the context of the story Reunion somehow.
I guess that raises the question of the existence of God, I guess, simply. And I say people ask me if I believe in God or if I'm an agnostic or where I stand on that front after my schooling. And I say, you know, aside from some silly jokes, but I'm mostly concerned with the book. And in there, I feel like there is a God, you know, in that world. And I mean, I do feel that in a sense when you're raised in that world and you leave that world, it's when I think of who I feel connected to in terms of biography, you know, every once in a while I pick up and peek in and find out, you know, say, oh, good, you know, Thomas Wolfe, you know, does obscene doodling in his notebooks, you know, like, that's another, again, I look at everything as a gift now because I found what I want to do. And so I'm thankful for things that I was maybe less thankful for, but I feel tied more to you know, and not making any work comparison, you know, I'm not that egotistical yet, we'll work on it, but in terms of Singer, like, people got to leave a very closed world. I mean, I feel like I grew up in a shtetl on Long Island, and there is a sense of real adventure, you know, when you leave that world. And it is that, you know, you're saying these things, and thank you for your very close reading, because they presses big buttons, it, you know, hits the spot. But it is that idea where you have to relearn things. You know, this idea the first time in Jerusalem, my first weekend, and I got on a bus while it was still, you know, Sabbath, and you assume, you know, a lightning bolt, or, you know, the bus will careen off a cliff, even though logic is functioning. And you say, you know, definition of God, if it's God, then God can't be that petty, because that would be beyond a, you know,
mm-hmm.
A God being could not be so petty as to strike you down immediately. That would not fit into my any logical definition of who should, what God could be, you know. But that idea of relearning all those things, or having to decide, it's that idea, people who are less, I see people who are, If they've grown up in a less religious structure and little bits of tradition, people will keep those traditions. If they, you know, take the bun off their cheeseburger on Passover, they will have a matzah cheeseburger for the rest of their life. You know, rest of their lives. You know, they were rest. Anyway, but they will. You know, and it's those things. But when you know what's what, I feel like when you've really studied things, you see that once you're leaving it, you're leaving it. That idea. If I know that, you know, eating non-kosher meat is the same as shaving with a straight edge, you know, in terms of sin, then if I'm already shaving with a straight edge, why keep it's that idea where you really give it all up, but then you're left without structures. I mean, it really is an exploration of sorts. And I mean, you know, if you're saying that about the characters, maybe that's where I leak into it. But it's that idea that it really is the unknown in terms of right and wrong. And, you know, thou shalt not kill. I'll keep that one. That for sure. I think that one's right on the money. You know, that and stuff like that. You start rebuilding your own morality.
I remember, yes, a kind of surreal relativism. I remember the first time I met Singer. It was snowing. It was in Buffalo. He said to me, in a tone of great assurance, "You will agree with me if I get an audience tonight. There is a God." He did. I mean, he got a very large audience.
Right. See that?
And you know,
question
then
answered.
Yes, exactly. And then and that there, you know, tonight there is a God was also the the implication there. I'm talking to Nathan Englander. He is the author of For the Relief of Unbearable Urges. And several of the stories revisit scenes that have been already tragic in Jewish literature and history, sometimes by repute. Thrillingly, as in The Master and Margarita by Bulgakov, there's a meeting of writers who, about to face a firing squad, debate aesthetics together and reputations. Mm-hmm. A wonderful conversation and debate. Similarly, a particular Hasidic sect in the story Tumblers want to get away from the less pure, the less observant Jews, and so they back to the further side of the train, taking them, one understands, to the camps, and they find themselves on a Gentile train, in fact, a train of circus performers who one presumes are going to be performing for Hitler that night. They are, they decide by their devotions, really, that in the course of this train ride, they will become tumblers. And I wanted to let you hear Nathan Englander read the last couple of pages of his really spectacular short story, Tumblers, from the collection For the
Relief of Unbearable Urges.
Uh-huh.
Thank you. Yes, so this is the end of the Tumblers. For a moment, then two, then three, they all stood at the back of the stage, blinded. Razel put a hand up to her eyes. There was a cough and then a chuckle. The echo had not yet come to rest when the Rebbe called out, "To your marks." Lifting their heads, straightening their postures, they spread out across the hard floor. "Hup," cried the Rebbe, and the routine commenced. Shraga cartwheeled and flipped. The widow Razel jumped once and then stood off to the side with her double-jointed arms turned inside out. Mendel, glorious Mendel, actually executed a springing half-Hanlon and, with Shmuel Beryl's assistance, his only real task, ended in a soaring angel. Feidel, off his mark, missed his wife as she came toward him in a leap. Zahava landed on her ankle, which let out a crisp, clear crack. She did not whimper, quickly standing up, though it was obvious, even from the balcony, that her foot was not on right. There was, after a gasp from the audience, silence. Then from above, from off to the left, a voice was heard. Mendel knew from which box it came. He knew it was the most polished, the most straight and tall, a maker of magic, to be sure. Of course, this is conjecture, for how could he see? "Look," said the voice, "they're as clumsy as Jews." There was a pause and then singular and boisterous laughter. The laughter echoed and was picked up by the audience, who laughed back with lesser glee. not wanting to overstep their bounds. Mendel looked back to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe shrugged. Young Shraga, a natural survivor, took a hop step as if to continue. Zahava moved toward the widow Razel and rested a hand on her shoulder. More, called the voice. The farce can't have already come to its end. More, it said. Another voice, that of a woman, came from the same place and barely carried to the stage. Yes, keep on, it said, more of the Jewish ballet. The fatuous laugh that followed, as with the other, was picked up by the audience in the cavernous echo so that it seemed even the wooden cherubim laughed from above. The Rebbe took a deep breath and began to tap with his foot. Mendel waved him off and stepped forward, moving downstage, the spotlight harsh and unforgiving against his skin. He reached out past the footlights into the dark, his hands cracked and bloodless, gnarled and intrusive. Mendel turned his palms upward, benighted. But there were no snipers, as there are for hands that reach out of the ghettos. No dogs, as for hands that reach out from the cracks in boxcar floors. No angels waiting, as they always do, for hands that reach out from chimneys into ash-clouded skies.
Nathan Englander, reading from For the Relief of Unbearable Urges, the story The Tumblers. Now, that seems to me to be one of the most risky endings in fiction. Did it come at the beginning, or was this one of the ones that got revised and revised and revised?
It's amazing, and I mean, I don't know if time or years of writing will help, but it's the things that you don't know that you know. I mean, I'm just, you know, glad it's getting attention. I feel like, you know, you're happy if it almost killed you. But that was it, that literally almost as it went to press in American Short Fiction, the people there, we talked about it and removed the last page that I had spent so much time on. It was just never right. It was never, ever, ever right. You know, this idea of bedlam breaking out, or maybe people charging the stage, you know, endless. And it's that idea where you know but you don't know until somebody says, like, you know, let's back up a little. And once I saw that cut and saw that point, you know, I spent not much longer moving commas and making that the ending. But yes, that was, I mean, one of those things, you know, hindsight, but I couldn't have known to know. But you're sort of happy inside when you find the right ending, that, you know, there's a reason that it never was right and it was never done with that extra couple of paragraphs that went past that, you know, past those skies.
I've been speaking to Nathan Englander about his collection of stories For the Relief of Unbearable Urges. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you very much.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Production assistance today from Alan Howard. Development by Beverly Walker. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's book of the mouse. Wow.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.